This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Ben Hiant, which is the highest hill in this area and the main landmark. You see it when you're sailing up the Sound of Mull. It's the most beautiful hill. I love all the sort of contours and the fact it's like a piece of tweed laid out, all the different greens at this time of year. And not too bracken. There's a few brackeny slopes, but it's fabulous. Lots of little burns, lots of steep cliffs, eagles. I've seen otters very high up on Ben Hiant too. It's a magic hill. It actually, in Gaelic, roughly translated, means the enchanted mountain. Uh-huh. And as far as I'm concerned, it is. It's just a fabulous place.
This is part of your childhood?
This is one of the first hills I climbed. And it's where I first learned about deer. I used to spend hours going up Ben Hiant on my own, not to the top, but just onto the slopes and watching the rut and watching the comings and goings of the deer. Loved it.
Who took you stalking for a start?
Well, my father took me out one Sunday during the rut. And we just went with binoculars, no guns or anything like that. And he took me where I'm going to take you now, actually. And I think there was a lot of acting going on. You know, we did a lot of stalking up the burn, and I followed him up with his big legs going behind. And it's just amazing. And we got very close. He was very, very keen on deer, and he knew an awful lot about them. I was very lucky. He's very keen on stalking. And that was where I really became completely passionate about red deer. I think they're fascinating.
Well, you're not just passionate about red deer, you're passionate about animals, full stop. When
yes,
did that start?
I am. Well, I think it's been going forever. The first real wildlife I saw probably was a tawny owl in a beautiful old sandstone, crumbling old stable block. And I used to rush home from school and crawl out to have a look at this tawny owl, which used to just sit there, absolutely lovely.
You've got one at the moment.
Yes, I have. I've got a permanent one at the moment that I've had for a wee while. And yes, I'm very keen on tawny owls. It's one of the birds that I get handed more than any other that's injured. The tawnies seem to get into terrible mischief, and they come into conflict with humans and get hit on the road and end up down people's chimneys. So I get quite a lot of calls about tawny owls. Great survivors, I think. They're one of the birds that seem to do quite well, actually, despite us.
We're just at the end of the bay at the moment, so the mountain's in front of us, but there is this flat area of land, and what strikes me is we're not walking down a walker's path. This is a track that presumably would have headed at some stage towards either a house or a village or something of the kind.
Yes, well, if you look here, there's a lot of little ruins. There's several ruins over there. There's one, two, three, four. We can see about half a dozen from here. So there was obviously quite a thriving community here. I mean, now this is very much the farm track down to Callister Gale here for the cut silage and things in there. Corn crakes here sometimes. I don't know if they were here this year because I wasn't around this summer. But they certainly have been here in the past.
Yeah.
And you get the stags try to get into the silage bags there and cause a bit of mayhem. You often see stags on the beach in the winter eating the seaweed there. And this was a bay. It looks very tempting for swimming. But we were always told as children that this was one where we really shouldn't swim. It's not the safest place to swim. No. The currents are not just very good. I didn't tend
bit
to swim
tidal.
Here. Yeah.
See,
I some people do, but I certainly never did.
I love this, because I'm kind of looking at it with a half-informed geological eye. And it's a volcanic landscape.
It's a very volcanic landscape, but I don't... Have you been over to the ring dikes on the far side? That's completely different.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather first came here and he thought it was like the moon. He said, what on earth made them come want to live in such a place? It's like the surface of the bloody moon, he said.
What was your childhood like?
I had the most fabulous childhood. I think I was so lucky. I was just allowed freedom, but we lived on the other side of this hill. But I would come up over it. And even as a small child, I used to wander quite a considerable distance on my own. I had a few, couple of girls at the primary school who were also quite keen on adventures. We used to spend a lot of time rock pooling. That was a great thing. And also we did this thing called burn fishing, where we would guddle about in the burn trying to catch wee trout. But we used to collect all sorts of funny pieces of broken polished china that was, you know, you'd find some lovely willow pattern and all sorts of things. And we used to make mosaics with it and things like that. But I was always out and about. We used to see wildcats here. I mean, it wasn't unusual to see wildcats when I was a child, which is extraordinary now when you think how I haven't seen one here for 10, 15 years now.
What did your folks do?
Well, my parents ran the Kilhone Hotel. And they had moved. My father had been a timber merchant in Liverpool. He'd inherited a timber business and absolutely hated it, totally ill-suited to it. So they decided, I mean, they had Scottish roots and they wanted to come back to Scotland, and they decided that they would look for a hotel. So it was between the Kilhone Hotel or the Summer Isles Hotel. Mm-hmm. And when we went to the Summer Isles, I remember going up there and just being absolutely blown away by the fact there was a hill called Stack Polly. I thought this was amazing when I was only very little. And when we were being shown around the Summer Isles, I'll never forget that the owner of the time said that food was very important, and even if they lived in a remote location, it was very important to have a very good cheese selection. And he said he always had an excellent English Stilton on the go, and he lifted this cheese barrel up, and I really am not exaggerating, there in the middle of the Stilton was a tiny little brown mouse cleaning its whiskers. And that was almost the thing that swayed my parents' decision about the Summer Isles of Kilhone. But happily Kilhone won, and they moved here, and it was a complete different world. Sadly, it didn't suit Dad. He was lonely, the winters were too long, and he unfortunately had a very serious drink issue, so running a hotel wasn't
the answer.
Yeah, but my mother loved it, and one of my first pets was Lulu, a black-faced pet lamb. You know, as soon as the locals heard that I was keen on animals, a pet lamb made its way to the door. And Lulu used to be seen carrying the morning tea up with my mother to the hotel guests, because at that time, you know, we didn't have making your own tea in a bedroom, so it was very different. We had a generator too at that point, so all the electricity, you know, it went off with the last light at night. And of course the generator would break down quite a lot, and so the guests would be plunged into the dark ages, which I'm sure added to it. A lot of the crofters at that point still just had lamps, you know, and we were lucky to have a generator.
You can probably hear now, we're only probably about 10 metres away from the surf. And this is us onto the shingle beach.
And it's very sandy when it's low tide here, and that was why we were always thought it would be a nice place to swim.
Yeah. You were talking earlier about the fact that you know, you're asked to rescue tawny owls. I mean, I've been to your house several times. You've always got stuff there. When did you start rescuing stuff? How did you learn?
Well, that's when I was very small. I really, as early as I can remember, wanted to be a vet. I loved mending things and fixing things, and you know, I used to find pigeons with broken wings or legs, and stuff. I was very inspired by a programme called Daktari, where there was a vet rushing around. It seemed all very glamorous, rescuing exotic things.
Clarence the cross-eyed lion.
Absolutely, and Judy the monkey.
Ah, yes.
So our yellow Labrador was Clarence, and I had a toy monkey, and used to play Daktari for ages, but a lot of rescuing. So, but then when I got to school, especially the secondary department, I realised that my brain was sadly extremely lacking in the scientific front. So it was very clear I wasn't going to be a vet. But I started to do a lot of working with vets in school holidays, and at school I was lucky to go and spend time with a vet too. We used to do community service, and my community service was vets.
Which way are we going?
I think we need to go a bit higher. I think we'll get fairly over the wellies.
The wellies were a good idea for
So I think that's when it really started. And then I suppose people just, I don't know, I got very interested in my mid-teens. And then when I was settled in Ochterarda, mm-hmm. I started to have a little bird hospital. And it's just kind of grown from that. Mm-hmm.
In what can only be described as a gentlemanly gesture, you give me your stick. Oh, eagles.
Two. There you are.
There you go. What are they?
Sea eagles.
Sea eagles, yeah.
I'll have a look. Big, aren't they? They really are huge.
They are flying barn doors.
I mean, when I was a child, we didn't see sea eagles here. I didn't see my first sea eagle till the late 1970s, and that was here at Akitenny at the other side. It must have come from Rum. Oh, it's flying nicely together, aren't they?
And they are just flying in formation. They're probably about 6-8 feet apart.
I noticed when they were a bit nearer that one of them's got, and obviously molting, there's quite a lot of feathers missing out of the flight feathers, there's big gaps. Ooh, look at them now.
Yeah. Ah, you were saying about your little bird hospital.
Yes, so I suppose I started it then, and it really grew. And then I did a vet nursing course, and then I worked in a zoo down south, and they had a lot of injured wildlife brought in. It was in Northamptonshire. And so I soon found I was sort of asked to look after a lot of this, and enjoyed working with the vets that came in to help with various exotic animals. So it's just kind of grown from that. I'd still love to be a vet, but honestly, the brain's really hopeless.
See, that surprises me, because your writing is always so clear, so analytical.
Yeah, but I can't do maths, and I can't do, you know, science. And I do remember sort of struggling with things like biology, which is really weird. There's the sort of technicalities of it. I don't know why, but yet I'm quite practical. It's odd. But I've always been interested in things like, I mean, it's rather awful to admit it, but parasites and ticks, and I mean, they're horrible, but it's fascinating how they survive. So I've always been interested in that aspect, and with farm animals as well. You know, they get a lot of diseases, and always intrigued me whether we could sort them or not.
You've got baby squirrels, or not so baby squirrels, in at the moment.
Yes, I was brought three little squirrels 7 weeks ago. They came from Athol Palace Garden in Pitlochry. And they were the smallest baby squirrels I'd ever been handed. And I must admit, when they arrived, I thought, no hope.
Mm-hmm. How old were they?
They were about 4 days old by their weight.
They must have been tiny.
They were tiny, and they were sort of naked and clammy. Uh-huh. And Anyway, first week, I was really feeding them every 2 or 3 hours, getting up through the night. And then they began to really pick up, and I thought, this is amazing. Nearly lost one of them one night. She got bloated, too much milk, and I thought she was a goner, but amazingly, they've survived, and they're now out in an aviary, which is why I was able to get away this time. Because the last time I came here, a month ago, I had to bring them with me. They were still small enough to transport, because they needed feeding all the time, and nobody else was able to do it. They were quite awkward. They didn't really like somebody else feeding them.
But when you have something that small, and they are extremely tiny, I mean, you know, but it's, you know, smaller than a mouse, and it's hairless, you can feed it, but how do you mimic being a mummy squirrel
difficult? I decided to, you know, you're always trying to learn from the last time you did it, and I'm very fortunate to have some mentors at the SSPCA at Fishcross. And then Romain Pitsey, the vet who does a lot of exotic things at Edinburgh Zoo, when there was a problem, I phoned him and he was really helpful. So I'm very fortunate to have these people who've got a lot of experience. And I suppose when you do any form of rehabilitation, the great thing is to pass on knowledge, to pick up knowledge from other people, because you can always improve it. So to answer your question about how did I mimic the mother squirrel, firstly, I had to keep them very warm. And then I had these little cotton wool pads, not cotton wool balls, because they would stick to them with they got quite sharp claws, even when they're newly born. And they would be, after every feed, I would have to wipe them all over with the moist, warm cotton wool. And then I devised a system of brushing them with a little squirrel hair brush. And then that would send them back to sleep. And then, because I imagine the mother, if you see...
Like squirrel massage.
Yes, exactly. You want to keep them very content and warm and relaxed. And I reckon The more you do that, the less likely they are to pick up infections. But, of course, that can all go wrong. Yeah. And they can pick up infections so easily.
So the mother in the dray would be feeding them and then grooming them.
Well, she would be licking them.
Licking them.
I did draw the line of licking them. Yeah, I thought maybe that was beyond me. Yeah.
Much as you love animals.
Yeah, I thought that was probably a wee bit much. But it seemed to work. I hadn't tried that before, but they certainly seemed to like it. There was some little delighted squeaks, which was good. Because they do get very stressed, obviously, without their mother. I think having three is a very good thing.
Yes.
You know, because they had each other. If it was just been one, it's much harder.
I've been in your aviary when you had a previous lot of young squirrels, and they basically just treat you like a climbing frame.
I know they do. I was just like a sort of human climbing frame, and in fact now we're at the commando training stage where they're out in the aviary and we just have to ignore them because we've got to stop that.
They've got to go wild again.
They've got to go wild
again. Do they?
I think they do, yes, quite quickly, especially if there's three of them. I think if we don't handle them at all, which we won't, and we just put the food out, then I think, yes, they do. Just look at the buzzard. It's tiny, isn't it? Look at that.
There's a buzzard behind two sea eagles, possibly the two sea eagles we saw earlier.
Yes, I think it is, because that's the one with all the gaps in the wing. You see, it's got huge gaps.
It's the fact that they can travel enormous distances without moving a wing.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
You can see them almost, you know, they go almost to mull, and I'm sure they don't have a wing beat.
Yeah.
Look at that. Right above us.
Yeah.
Definitely looking scruffy, aren't they?
Lords of the wind, right enough.
Well, you see, when I was here as a child, it was just golden eagles you saw.
You know, in many ways, what's happened in the Scottish countryside is, you know, there are other species now that didn't exist when we were kids. So white-tailed sea eagles, ospreys are much more common, red kites, kind of thing.
Yeah, doing really well.
But on the other hand, all the species that were extremely common, like lapwing, for example.
Going.
Yeah.
And curlew. I mean, you probably will hardly see any curlew here. And there used to be quite a few, but it's not the best habitat for them. But, yeah, it's really worrying.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've lost a lot, and we've gained some, but I think the losing is very worrying indeed. I mean, I really fret about it. And I mean, the farmland birds, the yellowhammers and things like that that we used to see on the tree pipits this year are well down. Some people say that's not the case, but I think it really is. I think things are really struggling. With the baby squirrels, I've been up in the night, and I've had the bedroom light on, and I've been downstairs feeding them in the kitchen for half an hour, and I've left the bedroom light on. When I go back up, the windows have been wide open. There's not a moth or a daddy long legs or anything. What's happened to all those insects that used to drive you mad when you left lights on? They're not there. It's worrying. And I mean, the thing is, where we are, we've got 15 acres and our neighbour has about 30. So we've got between us 45 acres that is not sprayed, not interfered with. And nature really has its head, which is fantastic. But it's an island in the middle of intensive agriculture, in the middle of intensively managed land for other purposes and intensive forestry. So, you know, it's an isolated thing, and I think what we've got to try to work towards is more connectivity and where places are connected to. So wildlife has corridors, and that's what we don't have. I think that's, you know, the UK is fast turning into little islands of isolated populations of things, and then things die out. Certainly in the red squirrel's case, they will die out eventually. You know, if they don't have new blood coming in and all that sort of thing, then it becomes very difficult. So I think this is a good place to stop. We've got a couple of good perches here, maybe a wee bit damp, but it's a good viewpoint. We're looking right out over Mull there, north end of Mull. And look up at these crags. This is a good place for seeing eagles. You see both sea eagles and golden eagles almost anywhere on the peninsula, but I always think this is a favoured haunt of the golden eagle on this side.
Again, we're looking along the headland, and it's basically just stony beaches, a succession of stony beaches sculpted. And then off to our right, this really interesting hillscape. Because it is volcanic and it's been worked on by time,
and successive ice ages and goodness knows what else, and water, the big waterfall there.
And you've got another croft on the shore there too, you know, another shealing there, and I wonder when that, whether the village we're going to go to, Borbleg, further up to our right, whether that would have been part of that, whether they would have used that when they brought little boats down here. When I was a child, there was one of the men that worked on the Loch Nell, which was the boat that came from Tobermory to Kilhoen twice a day, a passenger boat at that point only, and brought things from Tobermory. One of the crew there had, something had happened, and he went to spend the night in the small boat in Tobermory Bay to go out to the big, to Loch Nell to spend the night on the, hit that boat. I don't know if he's had a row with one of his family or something. Anyway, of course he misjudged it, and he got carried right across here in a little open boat in a huge storm, and he landed somewhere on the other side of McLean's Nose, which is that really steep bit you see jutting out there. And the boat smashed to smithereens on the rocks. And in pitch dark, in a real gale, he managed to make his way back to Mingory, where we lived. And I don't know who found him, but anyway, he was apparently in a dreadful state and really just hypothermic. But he survived. It was quite incredible. So that can be a treacherous piece of water. And, of course, when you get round Ardnamurchan Point, it's another thing altogether.
See, I was just sitting here thinking, how relaxing, how hypnotic the sound of that water and the wee geo below us is. Then you go and ruin it with a story like that.
But actually, I think the gales are quite hypnotic too. I quite
I
like
coming
here with
storms
for
hours.
Yes, I do too. I think they're fabulous. As long as you don't have to probably work in it, then it's fine.
No, true.
But I mean, it does get really, really windy here. And it does rain a lot.
I'm not going to ask you how you learned to write, because you write extremely well, but why did you want to write?
I suppose here, I was, when I was a child, I was always describing things I'd seen. You know, I remember going out and I was a great diary writer and letter writer, even as quite a small child, and I would write endless sort of things about the nature I was seeing all around me. So how did I start off? Quite difficult. I think it came from diaries, probably. And then I was collecting some injured birds. And a lady near Broughty Ferry had a wildlife hospital. And she died and left a whole lot of creatures that needed looking after.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, I was a licensed rehabilitation keeper, which you used to have to be licensed to keep certain birds of prey.
Uh-huh.
And so there were only a few in Tayside. Somebody got in touch with me and said, would you be prepared to take some of these kestrels and buzzards and various birds of prey and some owls? And I went along to this woman's house and I saw there was a... The daughter proudly showed me a folder of all the things this lady had written for the People's Friend of all magazines. And it was all sort of nature stories. And rather mercenarily, I thought, it's now not going to be doing that anymore. So I wrote to
you
the...
You spotted a gap in the market.
I did. I wrote to the editor and said, you know, I live on a farm and I think I've got some nice little stories. I had pet sheep that were always doing naughty things and there was a lot going on. And he said, can you come and meet me? And I was about 7 or 8 months pregnant and I went along and he said, oh, yeah, great, send me some pieces. And that's 30 years ago, so I've been doing it ever since.
How do you actually cope? I mean, you're obviously somebody who has to be outdoors, has to be in connection with nature. And yet, as a writer, eventually, reluctantly, you have to sit your backside down at a desk and get on with it.
It is a struggle. It's actually really hard if it's a lovely day, too. I find it really difficult.
Oh, that's murder.
The most murderous time of year is May for me, because when the bird song starts, I just want to be outside, and it's just so glorious.
Look, now they're coming to see us.
We're getting herded up. Huh?
Yeah. These youngsters are coming right the way down. They're now running parallel with us. We decided they're part of the herd.
We're having a very laxative effect on them too. Yeah. It's very excited now.
You were saying May, birdsong.
Yeah, so that's the hardest time I find it to write. But I think I tend to get up very, very early if I've got something to write. And if I come here to write, it's fantastic because you do get a lot of horrible days. So I find it very easy to write, holed up in the cottage with a gale rattling around us. And then when there's a break in it, I pop out for a dog walk and then come back and write. I think I tend to write better here than anywhere else because you get the peace. You don't get all the constant minutiae you have to deal with at home, which is a shame. Or I lock myself away. Yeah, I get a bit antisocial. It's hard for anybody else to understand that if you've got an idea, you want to go and get it down before you forget it. So here we are now at Borblaeg. It's quite an extraordinary place here, overlooking the Sound of Mull. It's supposed to be 26 families had a livelihood here. Quite hard to imagine.
It's interesting because essentially you're at the lower slopes of the mountain, but you can see that this has been tended land at some stage. There's almost a sort of a couple of football fields, yes, something like that.
If we go higher, we'll be able to look back and see. You can see the marks of the lazy beds. Maybe not quite so easy at this time of year, but you can actually see all sorts of marks of where they must have worked the land. Yeah.
These are not big houses either. I mean, this one behind us here would be, what, I don't know, 6-7 metres, and maybe it's not quite 20 metres wide, I would say.
And look at the ends of them. I mean, they're incredible.
Yeah. To shift these boulders up is a considerable achievement. You wonder what on earth they roofed them with, because there are no trees right here.
No. And it's sad, really, when you think, I don't know, maybe they wouldn't have survived anyway, but they were driven out by, I think, the landlord of the time was somebody, Sir James Riddle, I think, if I remember rightly. An old crofter, Malcolm Macmillan at Griggadale, on the other side of the peninsula, told me that they were driven out sometime in the 1800s, 1820s. Mm-hmm. And they moved to little other townships on the north coast of Ardnamurchan, and some probably would have moved much further away. Apparently they were burnt out, but I don't know. You know, this is something for a historian. I would know the full history of it.
When you see a cleared township like this, I don't know, maybe it makes you naturally maudlin. We were talking earlier about how things have changed in our lifetime, how there used to be a much greater wealth of species way back when. You would see many more of certain types of birds and animals and things. Do you ever sit and wonder if we've seen the best of it?
I do. I think we definitely have. I feel sorry for our children, actually. I think it's going to get a lot more difficult. But they won't have that cultural memory that I mentioned earlier. You know, they won't remember those days. And, you know, people tend to think that you're just being nostalgic when you talk about the heady days when there were hay fields full of birds and small mammals and things like that. And so there's an aspect where people think we're just being romantic. But I don't think we are. I think it is really very frightening what's happening just now.
So where do you find your optimism?
Well, that is always very difficult, and there are times when I become unbearably, unbearably depressed. I think the optimism comes when you see some of the work that's going on in certain places. I think there's a wonderful woodland down in the borders, Carafan, which I've never visited, but, I mean, things like that where people are really doing good work. Things like Trees for Life, where they're really working hard to bring back the Caledonian pine forest where it really was originally. These are moments of optimism, but it is very hard, terribly hard. I think we mustn't give up hope, but I freely admit I frequently do.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.